Hey, what's going on, everybody? It's John, Bam Bam the Dog. First, on behalf of both of us and everybody from the Real Ones team, I just want to sincerely thank you guys for tuning in. The folks that I bring on the show, they're family to me, and being able to tell their stories and bringing you into their world is something that I'm just super proud of, and again, grateful that you guys tune in. We've decided we want to take things just a step further. We're going to introduce a Patreon community, and basically what that means is if you become part of this community, look, I already bored Bam Bam. If you want to become a part of this community, you're going to be able to hear episodes early and all that, ad-free and all that good stuff. But there's all this behind-the-scenes footage, all this stuff that we've shot that really brings you into the folks that we've had on the show, really brings you into their world. You're going to be able to do live chats with me and the folks that I bring on the show to talk about their world, talk about the issues that they're dealing with, about their triumphs and their tragedies. Just go to Patreon/RealOnes. This whole idea was something about building bridges and bringing people together and bringing folks that often don't get the mic and giving the mic to them. So the fact that you guys tune in means the world. Anyways, again, thank you. Be good to each other out there. Rock and roll.
I wanted to start just by saying congratulations. You know, you are the Democratic nominee for governor of this state. Just looking at your life, man, you know, you're a best-selling author, a Rhodes Scholar. You fought for this country. You know, your accomplishments are staggering, and it's an honor for us to sit with you. I'm just wondering, both to your constituents or people that you're looking to get a vote from, and just in life, what? Yeah. How would you describe yourself? I mean, you're not a career politician. How would you describe yourself? What would you want people to know about you if they had no idea who you were?
Yeah. Ooh, I love that question. I mean, I think the main thing about me, what I try to explain to Marylanders is I'm a Marylander through and through.
Okay.
Right? And both in terms of family lineage, I'm a third generation Marylander and all that. But it's like my whole journey has been improbable from the onset.
Yep.
And I feel like for so many of the pathways, for so many things that I've been blessed to do, the things I've been able to see, where, I mean, this is a state where I've had some of my most amazing and some of my most traumatic memories mm-hmm. are all here in the state of Maryland. That I feel like so many of the journeys that Marylanders are going on, those are my journeys. Mm-hmm. That's my family. When we're talking about these things and when we talk about the future of the state, like, I take it very, very personally. And I move as such. And so I think there's a level of urgency in the way that I think about the world. I think I learned early about life's impermanence and the fact that when you believe in this idea and understand, I've seen the idea of life's impermanence, you just move at a different frequency because you know that nothing's going to be promised. So get busy now.
And do you feel like that sort of idea of impermanence and the fact of impermanence, did that come from losing your father? Do you think that's yeah. where that came from?
Definitely. I mean, it you know, kind of it's one of these things where I think about when some of your earliest memories are lost, it frames how you think of all of your future interactions.
Sure.
Right? Where, I mean, literally one of the first memories I had in my life was watching my father die in front of me. And he died because he didn't get the health care that he needed mm-hmm. and went to a hospital and they assumed there was assumption about whether or not he had insurance. Mm-hmm. And when my mom got to hospital, they asked her questions like, is he prone to exaggeration? And they asked him to leave. And they told him it gets worse to come back. And he died in front of me 5 hours later. That's literally one of the first memories I have on this planet, right? And something still very much seared into my mind. And so I think about that in that measure of context where this idea of unfairness
yep.
in the way that our systems are pulled together and broken out, it's still something that's very real to me. And so I feel like at a young age, I decided that I was going to devote my life to try to deal with these issues, devote the rest of my life to deal with, you know, inequities, devote the rest of my life to public service mm-hmm. in some way, shape, or form, mm-hmm. because I felt like that's what I was forged out of, about watching how these things show themselves in very real life. And that's just what I've tried to do.
You tell that story in your book about your dad, as well as a lot of other stories, but can you, because it's such a part of who you are as a person, can you just tell people about The Other Wes Moore and the construct of that book and, as much as anything, like why you decided to spend 2 years of your life? You weren't an author,
nope.
but why you spent 2 years of your life pursuing that story?
So I first learned about Wes through, you know, a series of wanted posters and where my mom contacted me. And she was like, you know, there are wanted posters in your neighborhood. And And I was, and actually I was, ironically, I was overseas at the time. I was in South Africa. And I was like, and this is the time when overseas calls weren't cheap.
Right.
You know, it wasn't like now where it's all free. Right. And I said, okay. And I said, but I don't know why this is justifying a long distance phone call. And she said, because they have the name, because they're looking for Wes Moore. And it's one of these things that kind of sits and it haunts you for a while. And the more I learned about this story and what happened, it was a botched jewelry store armed robbery where a police officer who was a 12-year veteran of the Baltimore Police Force, he was a three-time recipient of Police Officer of the Year. He was a father of five who just had triplets. And he was moonlighting as a security guard at a jewelry store so he could make extra money for his family. And that day, when he was working at the jewelry store, four guys went to go rob the jewelry store. And in this botched armed robbery, he was killed. And the more I learned about this story, the more I learned about this tragedy, the more I realized how much Wes and I had in common than just our name. That one of the people that the police were looking for was eventually captured and tried and convicted and sentenced was a guy whose name was also Wes Moore. And I had known Wes for a while and just writing each other backwards and forwards and that type of thing.
How did that begin though? Where is the kernel of that? Like how does that start?
You know, it was weird because I really started looking at these articles and learning more about this story, and I knew there were questions I wanted to ask, and he was the only one that can answer them. And so I literally ended up contacting, I knew he was at Jessup, which is about 15 miles outside of Baltimore,
sure,
at a correctional institution. And I was like, how do I get in touch with somebody who's an inmate there?
But that kernel, I'm so fascinated by that. That kernel, that desire, because I think intentionality is so it colors everything. You know,
everything.
It's everything starts there. Why are you doing this? I get the connection of the name. You developed obviously over time an experience with this man, this unbelievable, I think, empathy and this desire and this dig to understand it. But can you pinpoint, you know, what was the first question you really were dying to ask him?
And how did he respond to meeting you? I mean, what did he think of you reaching out to him and why you were doing that?
Well, you know, at first I wasn't even sure how he would respond. And I wasn't sure if he would respond,
mm-hmm,
right? Because he gets a letter from somebody who he didn't know who just shares his name. So mm-hmm, the first time I wrote him, the first letter was like, you know, hey, Wes, my name is Wes. Mm-hmm. Here's how I heard about you. Mm-hmm. And then I'm asking all these questions about like his family, or I knew his brother was also incarcerated because that's what I got from the newspaper articles.
Right.
And so the only thing I really knew about him was what the news was telling me about him. And so I feel like part of my challenge and part of the thing I wanted to try to answer for myself was all I know is what I'm being told to know. Is there more there?
Mm-hmm.
And these questions that I had, because you know so much of what I was heard and realizing was learning about Wes's life, these were all things that I had seen and understood.
Sure.
And so I was like, but what else is there? Is there more there that we wanted to try to understand? And then I wrote in this letter, and literally a month later, I get this note back from Jessup Correctional Institution from Wes. And I always say it was like if the letter he would have written me didn't make sense or like it was, you know, written in crayon or something.
Yeah,
I was like, okay, I guess I get it. And, you know, got what you needed. And it was one of the most interesting letters that I'd ever received, because in addition, like basically going and answering all the questions that I laid out, I think even the answers that he gave were not just fascinating, but they actually posed even more questions.
Mm.
And so that one letter turned to dozens of letters, and those dozens of letters eventually turned to dozens of visits. And that was how this interaction with Wes really was born out. And I think one of the big takeaways I try to illustrate and articulate in the book was that it wasn't even just about these two kids. It wasn't even just about a city or a state or whatever. It was about the fact that how thin this line is,
yep,
between our life and someone else's life, and how so many of these decisions that are impacting where we go are either decisions that we're not even making ourselves. And the people who we have in our lives who are helping us to make those decisions, how even when you have people making decisions that they think are in your best interests, it's still always being done from their perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
And so eventually, you know, after getting to know him, a friend of mine who's an author, who's a writer, she's like a legit writer. She like writes books, so she does. She always knew about this relationship that I have with Wes. And she was like, I think there's a bigger story here. I think you should tell it. And while I was hesitant at first, and I feel like I don't have time and all that kind of stuff, eventually I decided to do it. And that was you know, the origins for the other Westmore.
I'm really curious. I know you articulate a lot in your books and in other interviews, but I'm really curious if to hear what you learned from the process and specifically what you feel like you learned from Wes.
Yeah.
You know, a big takeaway for me was just this, again, this unbelievable amount of empathy. It's something that we kind of revisit a lot. I have a lot of soldiers on the show, a lot of folks that have served time, a lot of people in law enforcement. And one thing that we talk about in terms of masculinity is sort of the ultimate form of it, is this ability to put yourself in somebody else's shoes and to be willing to throw away your preconceived notions. I think there's often this misconception with folks who are incarcerated, folks who maybe could be potentially defined by their darker moments or defined by mistakes that they made, that potentially they didn't have people in their life that really cared about them. They didn't have people in their life that really wanted them to take a different path. And, you know, obviously in drawing so many similarities between your life and his life, he had people like they all dude that loved him and that he loved and that really wanted him to take a better path, and he did make really great choices and he was so close.
Yes.
Can you just sort of talk about that a little bit, and then specifically what you kind of learned, not just from the example of Wes, but the wisdom that you've gained from him specifically?
Yeah, you know, and it's wild because there is this idea, and you hit the nail on the head, this idea that, well, no one was there, no one cared, and that's not true. Like, I think about Wes's brother.
Yep.
And Wes's brother was, like, you know, straight up gangster.
He was really doing it.
He was like, he was in the life.
Yep.
Right. And he loved his little brother. Mm-hmm. And he was very much trying to steer his little brother away from the life that he had chosen for himself and the life that he was very much ingrained and involved in. But I think that, you know, he also maybe didn't fully appreciate the idea of the whole do as I say, not as I do thing for Wes was difficult to reconcile. That Wes saw his brother, you know, as respected in the streets. Wes saw his brother with all these things that Wes wanted. But his brother telling him, you don't want this life, you're not built for this, was difficult for Wes to be able to process as a young guy trying to navigate it. Same thing, you know, with his mom. I mean, Wes's mom is remarkable.
Yep.
And I think there's this, you know, this idea that, oh, Wes's mom was bad or, you know, so on and so forth. Wes's mom loved her children with all of her heart. Mm-hmm. She's also, you know, a woman who did not have the same access or the same resources or whatever like that other people would have had, even for my mom, where, you know, when my dad died in front of me, my mom was able to lean on her parents, mm-hmm. my grandparents. And so that's what brought me up from Maryland up to New York to go live with my grandparents. Wes's mom didn't have that option. And so I think that the idea for Wes, when we talk about how thin that line is, and there were people who were there trying to assist and help and guide and do all the things that we would hope that they would do, but they were also coming from limited assets, limited resources, you know, limited opportunities that then helped to shape what they could actually help to inform or support their child in the way they hope their child would actually be able to get. And I think about that in context of, there was one story that Wes told me, and I actually wrote about in the book, that still to this day breaks my heart, when he went through the Job Corps program.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know the story. I mean, it's he goes through Job Corps. It's a remarkable program that teaches job skills. He goes and gets a GED because he never made it past 10th grade, realizes that he's really good with his hands inside this program. But he's just going out and he's trying to find employment, and he can't find steady work because he always has this asterisk next to his name. So no one will hire him long term. No one will take a chance on him. He can't make wages. And by this time, Wes had already two kids. And so he's like, he needs to be able to protect and care for his family, but he can't find the opportunity to do so. So he goes back to the streets. And it just kills me because, to your point, and Wes even says, I never knew how close I was just to being done with that for good, but I never felt so far away.
Right.
Right. And that forces the decisions that unfortunately he then made to go back to the streets.
One of the things I love about the book is you very earnestly acknowledge the people who stepped up for you in your life and the advantages that you had that the other Westmore didn't have.
Yep.
And it's always interesting in this country, especially because we have such a by the bootstraps ethos. And most people want to believe that everything was by their own bootstraps. And for the vast majority of people, that wasn't true.
That's
and
right.
And one of the moments in that book that I love, by the way, is when you tell the story of you being sent away to military school, and by the way, the part about you running away through the woods is incredible. But talk a little bit about that piece of it and what being sent to military school in particular did for you at that exact juncture in your life, because it's very much a pivot point in your story.
Yeah, it was, and you're right. I mean, and you're right. I got sent. That wasn't a choice. That was not something I signed up for. And when I first got sent, it's because I was going through a whole bunch of issues, yep. You know, back at home, and my mom was basically like, you know, I can't do this anymore. And so she decided to send me to this school in Pennsylvania, and she even threatened me for years to send me away, and I never believed it. And finally, one day, she's like, you know, I'm sending you, and I was like, all right, mommy, I know I'm gonna work hard, and I blew her off, and she's like, nah, you're going next week, and started helping pack my stuff up, and. You know, and I think about it in context where I hated it when I first went. I ran away 5 times in the first 4 days. I didn't understand anything about this system. I didn't understand why they yelled at me when they're right here. I can hear you perfectly fine. You don't have to yell every time you open your mouth. Yeah. I understand why they had to wake us up at 5:30 in the morning. I don't understand anything about the whole military system. And oftentimes there is this idea that, you know, well, isn't it good that you got discipline? And, you know, the fact that they made us do push-ups and the fact that they woke us up early and the fact that all that kind of stuff, I mean, everyone goes through it. But actually, I don't think that's what changed me. And I don't think that's what changed my mentality. I actually think the point that I started to really change was when they started introducing leadership. That was different. And the military is very good about this, where very early on in the process, they're going to put you in charge of something. And they can put you in charge of something small. But they want you to taste responsibility. And so they'll say, okay, make sure a hallway is clean. And if the hallway is clean, we'll congratulate you. And if it's dirty, then Lord help you. And when the hallway is clean, they'll look and they'll say, all right, nice job, Moore. You know, hallway's clean. And then they'll notice you and they'll recognize you and then you'll get promoted. And then they'll give you a little more responsibility. And a little more responsibility. So there's this graduated sense of responsibility that the military is just honed at, mm-hmm. which ironically is no different than what you see in the streets and no different from what you see in communities, yep. right? Where no one ever starts off with major responsibility. No kid ever starts off as a kingpin.
You're not running the block.
When you first start. How it works, right? You get small responsibilities and then you grow yep. into it, right? Yep. Graduated sense of responsibilities. Yep. And so in many ways, what you're watching is a military organization that is now, a corporate organization that has just been carbon copied in terms of how they build networks, how they build pipelines. And so for what military school gave for me was just a level of responsibility and a level of accountability and leadership that I had not seen in that same kind of frame, and something that I eventually just fell in love with.
And it seems like it also kind of started you down the path of service, right? I mean, you talk a lot about that on the campaign trail, and leadership is service, right? Yes. At its core, it is about serving other people and something bigger than yourself.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were talking on the way over here just about the fact that service is on the decline in this country. Like, yep. people are volunteering less than they used to. There's less interest in joining the military than there used to be. So how do you—
A lot of people aren't in good enough shape to join it.
Yeah.
That's true, too.
And that's another part of it. And so how do you think about that as, like, you potentially enter this next phase of your life where you're even more visible as somebody for whom service has been so core to who you are? But the lack of service starting to rupture the social fabric in this country a little bit.
Yes.
So what do we do about that?
It's that lack of service leads to a lack of connectivity. You know, the understanding that you're part of something bigger than yourself. So for example, you know, in the state of Maryland, one of the issues that we're campaigning on and we will have happen is Maryland is going to be the first state in this country that is going to have a service year option for every single high school graduate.
Wow.
Every
what does that look
graduate.
Like?
So what it's going to look like is every student as they finish high school will have, and they can choose. They can say, I want to work in the environment. And we're going to have them help build seawalls to address rising sea levels. Or I want to work on tree canopy. So for example, Baltimore City, where we are right now, is the seventh hottest heat island in the country because of a lack of tree canopy. Right? And so having them go out and planting trees to focus on increasing tree canopy. All these are things that we have to do as a society, and we're about to put young people to work to do all these things, housing, education, infrastructure, all this kind of stuff, right? And they can choose however they want to do it. And we're going to do it for three reasons. And they're going to do it for a year, paid service. And we're going to do it for three reasons. One is I'm a big believer in experiential learning, giving young people a chance to see something different and then it'll give them a pathway to get there. The second reason is because it's going to help address the college affordability crisis, which is a crisis in this country. And the third reason, it's because service is sticky. You know, those who serve together generally stay together. And in this time of political divisiveness and vitriol, you know, service will help to save us. I mean, I saw it where, you know, even during the campaign trail, you know, there are people who, you know, who I was with in Afghanistan who came from all over the country to come campaign for me here in Maryland. And some of them weren't even Democrats. Right. But they're like, I can't tell you. They're like, so I'm here just to tell you about the person I serve with, the human being that I was in Afghanistan with, and who were out there door knocking and campaigning, not for a political ideology, but for the person I served with, because I know him and I've seen him battle tested. And all we're simply saying is, if we know that in our society that service is sticky, I believe that people who serve together will stay together, and service will help to save us in this moment, because we've got to make people and all of our young people feel this sense of connection to something bigger than themselves. And that'll help to get them involved in a myriad of different things that they'll end up doing later on in life as well.
I love what you say about service and what you said about the military in particular. You know, I've been blessed to have a lot of friends who served and be sort of invited as a guest into a lot of these communities, and it's an honor that I hold sacred. And I see that, and it's interestingly, I think it's similar on a different scale to what we're talking about football. You know, you've been there, you've been on the field, and why do you think that is? I mean, your very survival depends on each other. You're constantly being tested every single day. So you literally see who each other is and what each other are about. You depend on each other. And so all this other bullshit, like what political party you are, what race you are, who you're sleeping with, all that goes out the window. And I'm judging you for the content of your character and who you are. Will you step up? Will you not step up? And is that a meritocracy? I mean, how would you describe that? Why is that bond, that adhesive so strong?
I think it's strong because it's a chance to see people in their rawest form.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I think about it where I don't learn anything about anybody when I watch them in times of comfort. Because in a time of comfort, you can show me anything you want to show me.
That's right.
You know what I mean?
That's right.
I learn anything I ever need to see about somebody and watch them when it's hard.
That's right. Turn the heat up.
Turn the heat up,
yep.
And watch how they perform.
Yep.
Watch how they either flourish or watch how they wither.
Yep.
When things get tough.
Yep.
I've had the chance to see and experience, you know, my brothers and sisters who I serve with. I have seen them at their best. I've seen them at their worst. I've seen them at their most tested. I've seen them at their most frustrated. I've seen them at their most angry. And I see them when we strip all the stuff away for who they are. Mm-hmm. And I love them for it. And they've seen the same thing from me,
for sure.
Right? They've seen me when it is all on the line. And they've seen me when, you know, you're not as hard as you say you were.
Right.
Or times when like, holy shit, like this, like he really stepped up. Like they've seen this. And I think it's something that you always then hold on to. And I think that's part of the beauty of service in that way, right? It really gives people a unique opportunity to be tested and to be vulnerable, and then to have a chance to build up as a collective that you just don't have many other opportunities in life to be able to see from people.
And how does that affect you as a parent? I mean, how does that affect you in how you're raising your children and sort of creating? Because I imagine, we all are dealing with it in some day. The world is so different. My kids certainly aren't growing up the way that I grew up. How do you create adversity? Because that's really what it is. Like you need that test. How are you doing that? How are you succeeding? How are you failing?
Oh man. You know, I remember someone said something to me when they said, and I thought it was a great way of putting it. They said, I don't want, and the person I'm talking about, he had a tough childhood coming up. And he said, I don't want my children to grow up hungry like I did, but I want my children to grow up hungry like I did. And I thought that was just such a great way of laying it out, where it's like,
absolutely.
I never want to have my children experience some of the things that I experienced coming up. Mm-hmm. Like, and I will do anything to make sure they never have to feel some of the ways that I felt experience things that I felt, see the things that I had to see. Yet at the same time, I want them to feel what it means to struggle. I want them to feel what it feels like to go through experiences where success is not guaranteed, mm-hmm. where you're not gonna get a trophy, you're not gonna get a prize just because you showed up. Mm-hmm. Like, you gotta work. Mm-hmm. You gotta outwork everybody. Mm-hmm. And I think that not only do we try to place that in times of, you know, in the structures around our kids' lives, and yep. part of the reason why you want them involved in sports, you want them involved in activities, you want them involved in things where the wins and the losses are not determined by anything but how you perform on a field. But I think the other thing is too is I want them to see it. I want them to be able to look up at me and look at their mom and their family and see, like, these are grinders. Because I almost am a big believer that we as human beings and children, they will take and embrace what is around them and they will inherit it. It's part of the reason why I'm really proud of this campaign that we've run, where nothing was given to us. We were a campaign that nobody saw coming. I mean, and you look at the primary alone, we had two cabinet secretaries, head of the DNC, people who run statewide office before. And then here's this guy who was a nonprofit exec,
yeah,
an author,
yeah.
who said, you know what, I need to be in this conversation too. We worked,
yeah.
and we earned it. And it's exactly the type of thing that I also wanted for our kids. It's both about the structures we're putting in place to them to understand what it means, but I need them to look up and to be able to say, that's what hard work looks like.
Yep.
And that's what is required in order to be successful.
I think that process of making your kids uncomfortable and forcing them into uncomfortable places is like as hard as a parent, but you got to do it.
Got to do it. And you're not doing them any favors when you're not.
Yeah. I got a question for you though, because when you think about your campaign, you know, one of the things you talk about in your book a little bit is you talk about Colin Powell and his book and the influence that that had on you. And Colin Powell is kind of a pragmatist, and he decided his pathway was change the system kind of from the inside, because he was going to be a part of it, and that was going to be his pathway towards change. And on the one hand, you're a total outsider in this world because you never run for office before. You're a total newbie in this universe. But your pathway to change is a little bit the pathway of the person coming from the inside, which is change the system as it exists, not be the Bernie Sanders or the AOC who says, you know what, revolution is needed. How do you, as a candidate and as a potential governor, how do you bridge those two sides of your own party in a way?
Yeah.
The side that's like, pragmatism is the right pathway to the outcome we desire versus the side that's like, break it down. It's not working. We got to start over.
Yeah. The way I look at it is we really had to come from a perspective of understanding what's the challenge that you're trying to fix in the first place. You know, so for example, I remember we were working on an issue called the child tax credit, which is basically it's a policy that's been put in place that's supposed to end and address the issue of child poverty. The problem is that we had a policy that was put in place that there was essentially almost like an earn-in. So it was leaving millions of children out because they were too deep into poverty because they didn't hit a classification for an earn-in, right? So literally 27 million children were not qualifying for the child tax credit, which makes absolutely no sense to me. Right? You have a poverty-fighting tool that's leaving 27 million children out because they're too deep into poverty. And so by making some simple adjustments to it, by making it fully refundable, by paying it out monthly instead of annually, because I don't know anyone that gets paid annually, everyone's living month to month, right? You could literally help to cut the child poverty rate in this country by half. We were working hard on this issue because I ran one of the largest poverty-fighting organizations in this country. And I remember working with the governor on this issue and saying, here's what you should do. Tell him about, you know, here's what the policy could look like. Gave him all the data around it. Literally was like, this is what you should put in the state of the state and how you can make a revolutionary change. And was looking at this, you know, looking at the platform, looking at some of the work around it, and realized that there was nothing in there about the work that we were doing. And so I'm upset. We worked a long time on this. And I started speaking to one of my colleagues on this. And he said to me, he's like, you know, we've been working for 6 months to get them to include a line in a speech, right, to make this adjustment. And he was like, well, what if you could write the whole speech? And that's the point. What if you could write the whole speech?
You could be the guy, yeah.
So it's one thing to go and advocate for this and move on this or push and lobby for that. And it's one thing to be a person with the pen in your hand and to be able to say, of all the issues that we all have devoted our lives to, issues like ending child poverty, issues like ending the racial wealth gap, issues like ending environmental injustice, what if you could actually be in charge of the budget that could help to address those things? And also, when you're looking at budgetary allotments, is the reason that those things exist in the first place. Because these are decisions. There's an intentionality to inequity.
Yep.
And I think that's something that we had to approach. And so I think part of the reason that I then said, this is the time where you look at so many of these things, these are generational challenges that we're talking about. There's nothing, you know, educational systems that aren't equal for every child, that's not a new thing. I mean, we've been dealing with that for as long as, you know, as long as we know, right? And so if we have a generational opportunity to create generational change for generational challenges, well, that's the thing that I got excited about, saying, why don't we just write the whole speech?
What do you say to the person who is just sort of given up on the divisive, just giving up on politics in this country, just don't believe? The divisions have and the agendas have become so strong, and they're not buying it. Growing up in DC, obviously, you know, it's like growing up in Hollywood with the movie business. You know, my family had nothing to do with politics, but it's sort of unavoidable when you grow up there. And I remember, you know, growing up, I became enormously close with Teresa Bradley, Bill Bradley's daughter. And, you know, I just thought he was the coolest dude in the world because he was so tall, you know, and he took me to a Knicks game once.
He's a good ball player.
You know what I'm saying? Like Spike Lee came over and said, what's up? That was crazy. You know what I mean? And, you know, but I remember when he was running for president, I remember he said succinctly to Teresa, you know, whether I win or lose here is totally dependent on whether I followed my North Star of being truly authentic to myself, mm-hmm. whether I didn't violate my own beliefs to try to garner a vote, to try to get something. And, you know, to me, when I look at leaders, when I look at people that I would follow anywhere, it's folks that I've experienced things with. It's folks, and for me, I need to be in the box with that person. I need to see. I've read your work. I'm so taken with you. I'm so taken with what you're about and the things that you've done. One, like, what's your North Star? You know, who is your authentic self? But two, what do you say to people who just believe politicians by nature are fluid and are changing and are part of a divisive kind of structure in this country that's completely corrosive?
Yeah.
That's a long-ass question. I apologize.
No, it's a great question.
You know, this ain't McLaughlin group. I'm doing the best I can, man. You know what I mean? I really, it's a lot of questions in one, but I'm genuinely interested.
Dude, I'm loving this, man.
Okay, that's what I'm saying. Okay.
You know, I would say, you know, first in when I think about my North Star, it's just authenticity. I remember having this conversation. In fact, I was having this conversation with Dougie when, as we first got on board. I said, listen, I have no problem spending all day long introducing myself to people who don't know me. Mm-hmm. I won't spend a second of the day reintroducing myself to people who do. I am who I am. And I never want a situation where people who are like, I thought I knew Wes, but now that he's going into politics, I'm seeing a different person.
Right.
I'm hearing different issues. I'm like, nah, like everything we're talking about, these are issues that we've been working on for my whole adult life. And I am who I am. You know what I mean? And so I think authenticity and being able to move with a sense of urgency does become important. I think it's the same thing where, you know, you think about, you know, someone actually was actually saying the other day when they were reading the works, whether it's the other Westmore or the work, et cetera, they're like, I feel like I'm already getting a sense of your platform because you told us a decade ago about what matters and what kind of stuff you care about, right? And for the people who feel frustrated about the system, I guess my answer is, I hear you. And it's justified. For so many of us, our lives and what's happened in our lives don't give us a reason to believe that this thing can change. My grandfather was the first one in my mom's side of the family born in this country. And his father, my great-grandfather, was a minister, and he was a vocal minister. Like one of these dudes who was like, I'm not just gonna teach you the word, I'm gonna ask you to live it here on earth. And eventually he started getting threats, and eventually the Ku Klux Klan started making physical threats to him and his family. In the middle of the night, he picked up his family, to include my grandfather, and moved. And so the Ku Klux Klan ran them out. And it wasn't just ran them out of the community, they ran them out of the country. They went to Jamaica. And for most of my family, for much of my side of the family, they always vowed to never come back to this country, and they didn't. They stayed in Jamaica. So that's why, you know, I'm a proud Yardie. I still got a lot of family down in Jamaica. Yeah. But my grandfather didn't. My grandfather, in all, I always say, in all of his humility, said, this country would be incomplete without me. And he came back here. He went to an HBCU. He eventually became a minister like his father. He became the first black minister in the history of the Dutch Reformed Church. And I always say, this is a man who, he died at 87. He died when I was in Afghanistan. And he had a deep Jamaican accent his entire life and was maybe the most patriotic American I've ever met.
Wow.
He loved this country. He loved this nation with his deep Jamaican accent.
Mm.
And I think about him often on this idea where when people have a sense of frustration that things can't change or whatever like that, like I hear them and I can't question their feeling about it, because the truth is that this journey, this route, it's been remarkable and it's been uneven. But I also know that when I think about like my grandfather, a person who just believes so deeply in what this nation hoped to be, that he believes so deeply in the idea of community, that with each passing time and each passing moment, we actually could be better. And I think about now that that man's grandson is on the cusp of becoming the first black governor in the history of a state. I can't give up.
Mm.
I can't give in. Like I've seen the breakage and I've seen the rebuilding.
Yep. Yep.
And so the thing that keeps me going is I know what's real, but it's only real if we will it. It ain't gonna happen because of inevitability. No, it ain't gonna happen because we show up.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
You gotta work. And I just choose not to curl up in a fetal position. I choose to work because I've seen what can happen if we do, because I had examples that I came up with that showed me that.
Sure.
Talk a little bit about Maryland, because you started this by saying you're a proud Marylander, you love this state.
I do.
We both grew up here. We're not the best known state in the country, so not everybody knows what makes Maryland great. What do you love about Maryland? Like when you think about it, what do you tell people about this state?
I love the fact that, you know, and for all those non-Marylanders out there, you know, for us Marylanders, you know, Maryland is known as American miniature, right? Where within a 2-3 hour basis, you can go from the hills and the mountains, you can go mountain climbing to the beach, that you can go from skyscrapers to farmland. It's literally anything that you want in the country, you're gonna be able to see and get.
And all kinds of people.
And all kinds of people. And I love that about this state, right? Yep. I love the diversity of the state. I love the fact that, you know, I could sit there and have, you know, in the morning have conversations with crab pickers, and then later on have conversations with, you know, with attorneys and doctors, and then later on turn around and have conversations with someone who's recently released, who's now coming home, to someone who has been been working at a paper mill, that's just gone out of business, now trying to figure out what they're gonna do because their whole town just lost their largest industry. Like, I love the fact I can have all these various conversations in one day.
Yep.
One day in the state of Maryland. And I think about all the assets that we have here in the state of Maryland, where I always say, you know, the state of Maryland, this is literally the home of everything from the Port of Baltimore to you know, the Chesapeake Bay, to the NIH and the CDC, to NASA, to, you know, four of the top HBCUs, historic black college universities in this country.
Yep.
Like, we've got so much here, but we are asset rich and strategy poor, where we have all these assets here. And it's amazing how arbitrary and miserly we are about who can actually benefit from those assets and how we leverage those assets.
Mm.
And so one of the things I'm really excited about is both creating a society, you know, we have on our campaign what we call, you know, the Leave No One Behind agenda. And that actually came from the military, where, you know, I first, you know, joined when I was 17, and, you know, a mantra they asked us to live by when I first joined the military was leave no one behind. Every mission will be evaluated on that. Leave no one behind. And that is the philosophy that I want the state of Maryland to take come January. We will be a state that leaves no one behind, because we don't have to. But the whole basis of the Leave No One Behind agenda is, as a state, we are going to grow. As a state, we are going to compete. As a state, we are going to win. As a state, we are going to recruit. I'm going to take the state on an 8-year roadshow. I want to show the country that this is where you want to be. But we will leave no one behind in the process. And that's the vision, and that's the mission.
With that, you know, look, you know, growing up in and around D.C., it's incredible because Baltimore is just 35 minutes away, and culturally there's notion, you know, like we just have nothing. We have different music in DC. We have a different vernacular. We have, it's just, and it's weird, you know, growing up there my whole life, you know, I went up there, played a couple football games up there, you know, went to some Orioles games, but just really had such little experience with it. And, you know, this last year I got to spend, you know, some real time in the city, shooting a TV show there. And
a great TV show.
You know, the best part of what I get to do, without a doubt, is the people that I get to meet. And sometimes we get to explore, you know, a topic that unfortunately is discussed by people that know nothing about it. And it's just this bunch of people waving flags from the sidelines that absolutely requires, the nuance requires to dig into the wound of it and talk to the people that are actually living it every day. And I really felt that I got to explore it in that way, not just through the play acting that we did, but by going on ride-alongs every day with every district in this city, going out with the SWAT team, getting to understand the community, getting to spend real time with the community. And I just want to talk about Baltimore a little bit because it is my heart now. I'm so excited to be back here. You know, we're going to go into the Eastern today and tonight to meet some of my friends from the BPD and
love it.
You know, some people in the community as well. Going to talk with Peanut King. I don't know. Yeah, a little bit later. But it's such a brutal but beautiful city. And I'm just wondering if you can kind of talk about Baltimore a little bit. And you talk about, you know, people being left behind. There's a lot of folks that are struggling here. There's a lot of folks that are in an environment that is, I think, would be staggering if folks from other parts of this country saw it and experienced it. What folks got to live with on a day in and day out. And look, it's a big question, but I just want to hear your thoughts on Baltimore and what are your plans? How would you attack it? But also just kind of policing in general and what your thoughts are there.
Well, I tell you, I mean, honestly, like when I think about Baltimore, it's not political, it's personal.
Yeah.
This is home for me.
Yeah.
And, you know, all I'm gonna say is, you know, I wasn't born in Baltimore. I chose Baltimore because, you know, after my father died and we moved up to New York, my mom, the first job that my mom got that gave her benefits, first job that she got that gave her reliable hours was at a place called the Annie E. Casey Foundation, which is right here in Mount Vernon in Baltimore. And it was the first place that I ever came to at that time. And again, my mom got that job when I was 14. But that was the first time that I actually felt I had found home. The first time that I found a place that I felt accepted me for who I was. Because I moved around a lot when I was young because of trauma, right? I mean, I didn't have a permanent connection to anywhere until I came to Baltimore. And as my mother said at that point, she's like, I couldn't keep him out of the city. This was a place that embraced me. This is a place that I have some of my longest and most lasting friendships. This is a place that, you know, I know this city and I feel like the city knows me, right? And the reason that I'm so passionate about what we can actually get done about supporting Baltimore and what I tell people from around the state is also, it's not just because I'm a homer. It's not because, I'm Baltimore and I'm a, you know, rep from my hometown.
Right.
It's because you cannot have a thriving Maryland if you have an unhealthy Baltimore.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's just math, right? It's the state's largest city. And right now, it's the state's largest city that is going on 7+ years of 300+ homicides. It's the state's largest city where we still have children who cannot drink from the water fountains in the schools that they attend because of lead. It's the state's largest city that we're dealing with issues and challenges of where one in six folks and adults in the city are dealing with addiction issues. State's largest city that the city of Baltimore has double the poverty rate of the rest of the state of Maryland. And so if we want Maryland to do what Maryland can do, we need Baltimore to be able to help lead this charge. And so when we talk about things like, what does it mean to think holistically about Baltimore? You know, for me, yes, it does mean that we have to make sure that people are coming up in safe environments. We've got to prioritize public safety. We have to make sure that there is no reason for children to grow up in fear of their own neighborhoods. And so that does mean we have to make sure we are getting violent offenders off of our streets. We've got to get these illegal guns that continue to flood into our neighborhoods off of our streets. We have to have a policing force that moves with appropriate intensity and absolute integrity and full accountability. Get all that. But it also means we have to be able to move in partnership to be able to make those things happen. That we have to have a 21st century education system that's actually teaching our students how not just to be employees, but how to be employers and actually training them and preparing them for the jobs of now, for the jobs of the future. Right now in Maryland, we have 2 available jobs for every single person filing for unemployment. And people are like, well, how does that make sense? It makes sense because we have a dynamic economy in the state where it's biotech, cybertech, agritech, all the kind of stuff. And we're not preparing our students and our workers to participate in that economy. So we have available jobs, but people who are not trained and skilled to actually fill those jobs.
So why is that? Is that just a funding question? Is that just, you know, not enough dollars and cents? Or is it the money's been spent the wrong way? What's at the root of that?
Yeah, it's yes, there's a funding challenge where you do watch areas that are underfunded, and that is real. And so I worked on this platform called the Blueprint for Maryland's Future, which was a groundbreaking piece of education legislation where it does talk about how are we investing in the things that we know make sense. Free pre-K for every child in need in the state of Maryland, making sure you're creating pipelines for educators of color inside of classrooms, you know, being able to invest in apprenticeship programs and trade programs, because not every student's gonna go on to a 4-year college. So there is stuff like that, but it is also about accountability. It can never just be about, okay, let's just give a check here and give a check there, and then we'll see how things work out. Full accountability is a core part of the blueprint and what we plan on, you know, operationalizing and putting in place, but that has to be a part of our larger vision, that it's about funding, but also making sure there's full accountability as to how that's actually going to work.
By the way, I think it's great being a homer.
I agree.
Have everybody I know in my life will talk about the place they come from, whether it is the tiniest podunk town or it's a big city, and they'll tell you it's the greatest place on earth and you got to visit there. But you never care about anywhere like you where you grew up, right?
And I just wish people felt that way about this country in general, because honestly, listening to you talk and the way that you said, you know, first of all, I'm a Marylander, you talk about the way you grew up, and I mean, that is your story is an unbelievably American story. And I think tragically, so is the other Westmores, you know?
Right.
And I think that in there kind of lies the issue. And you know, my time, I don't mean to just sort of like focus on the police thing. It's just, it's such an immediate issue here, yes. You know, because if you're not safe, so many of the folks in this department are from this community. And yes. I find, you know, those are the folks that we really need to be listening to and empowering.
That's right.
People with real, real care for this community, who themselves are homers and really care about the communities in which they police. And I'm just wondering, how do you implement that? Like, how do you address that?
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, one is making sure that we are recruiting folks who do understand and feel a measured sense of connection with community is important, because, you know, one fundamental question you have about policing is, as people going out in communities, what do you see? Right? When I see that kid over there, what do I see? Is that Ms. Johnson's grandson?
That's right.
Is that, oh, that's my nephew? Is that so-and-so? Is that, oh, listen, Scott, let me talk to you for a second. Or is that a threat? Or is that something that I'm now should be or, you know, taught to be afraid of, right? So we do need to make sure that there's a real sense of connection mm-hmm. between community and law enforcement, because without that, it's going to be impossible for law enforcement to be able to do its job. But we also have to be able to support law enforcement in doing this work, where right now, I mean, you look at, for example, the Department of Parole and Probation in the state of Maryland, and that's a state function. If you look at a third of all people who are involved in violent crime in our areas are people who are in violation of parole and probation.
That's right.
So you're having people who are dealing with a problem, dealing with a challenge that their jurisdiction and their you know, that BPD, Baltimore Police, they're not responsible for that. That's a state function. But if a state function is not working, if you have over 150 vacancies in the Department of Parole and Probation, then you're putting all the weight on BPD to try to deal with that issue. If you're looking at the fact that you have homicide detectives right now in the city of Baltimore, we've got a 41% closure rate for homicides. So basically, if I commit a homicide in Baltimore, I got a better chance of getting away with
That's
it.
That's right. That's
right. You know? You have homicide detectives that are working multiple cases all at the same time, which makes them completing their job functionally impossible, right? You could actually take state resources, put them on loan to the city of Baltimore to decrease the workload, increase the closure rate, and make communities more safe, right? But we have a real issue with that here. And so we're never going to, and I believe deeply, we are never going to either arrest or militarize our way out of this,
right.
out of something that's a larger societal
right.
problem.
Right.
We've got to deal with a lot of the structural issues that are taking place and on board. And at the same time, we have to make sure that we have policing that is accountable.
Yep.
We have to make sure that when people go outside the lines, that there is measures of accountability for going outside the lines. because that's only going to help out the people who are on the force,
that's right,
who are doing good work,
yeah,
but find themselves in a situation where, you know, it's difficult to separate when you have people who are not in there for the best intentions and for the best purpose.
Look, nothing hurts good police more than bad police.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, that's the...
And we saw that with the military.
I'm sure.
Nothing hurt us more than soldiers who did not understand the basic rules of law and the basic training that we put in place. That made us less safe. And that's the last thing I ever wanted was someone who, you know, and I have personal situations where we saw that and we dealt with that, mm-hmm, where we then became less safe because of people who did not understand or respect the uniforms that we were all wearing. It made us all less safe.
You know, if you don't mind, just going back to, you know, your dad and you know, what you said earlier and also from the book, it you know, it really, really resonated with me. And what do you think he'd be most proud of today with you? I mean, what do you mm-hmm think in just
Yeah. I mean, I feel like he's still very much a constant presence with me. Like I still talk to him.
I bet.
I still, when good things happen or when times are tough, you know, I always take a moment and take a beat. And in my quiet time, I just talk to him. I ask him. I feel like all my most special moments in my life, he's been there for him. And I really do believe that so many of the blessings that I've had in my life and so many of the things that have worked out to my benefit, they're actually like impossible. But I feel like he's up there moving some things around.
There you go.
You know, he's thrown me quite a few assists.
Hmm.
And I really do believe that. And I also do believe I'm gonna see him again at some point.
Yep.
But you know, I think the thing that I hope that he sees, and you know, both about them, you know, I try to be a person of my word. I try to be a person who moves with urgency. I try to be a person that takes seriously the fact that I carry both his name and that I carry his DNA. But I also take a real pride in the fact that I've tried to be a good son to his wife. I've tried to be a good dad to his grandkids. I've tried to be a good husband to his daughter-in-law. Because I think that's something tough he'd also that he would care about a lot, is take care of your people. Take care of your folks. Because that's what he always did for his family. And so that's what I try to do for mine.
I guess one, you know, thing for me I'm just so curious about with this show and this environment is, you know, we talk a lot about connectivity and the fact that, you know, there's a dire need to lower the temperature and for people to be able to have conversations with people that they may not agree with in every way, shape, or form, but be able to do that in a way where you're actually imbibing some truth that may not sit well with you. And I guess my question for you, just, you know, as it relates to what we're trying to do here is, you know, number one, do you have Republican friends? And number two, you know, how do you think about those conversations with them as you potentially take on the job of a governor of a state that is very heavily Democratic? And it would be possible to tune those folks out. How do you think about those relationships? And number one, do you have them? And number two, how do those dynamics, you know, work with you? And do they enhance you?
Yeah, quite a few. And you know, it's funny because you are right. I mean, you could look at the map of Maryland and say, all right, you need to spend all your time in these four jurisdictions and you could win this race. And you could literally ignore the rest and just spend all your time here, rack up vote totals and get the victory that you needed. The problem is that's not who I plan on governing. So I'm not going to start now. You know, I plan on using this campaign as a way to try to demonstrate to people how I plan on governing. And even when we go out and even during the primary, we literally going to places where people during, because we've closed primaries, so people couldn't even vote for me if they wanted to, because they're Republicans or independents. And people would say, you're spending a lot of time in a lot of areas where there's not a lot of Democrats.
Yeah, yeah.
And my answer was, yeah, but there's a lot of Marylanders. And I plan on being their governor too. And I want them to know that I'm not just coming. The first time I'm coming to them is not just to ask them for a vote. I mean, the first time I'm coming to them is I want to be able to share my vision and my values. I want to hear, you know, what are their challenges and their opportunities. And let's start that relationship there. Even if the first time I'm having that conversation with them, they legally could not even vote for me. And I do think about that, and where, you know, I remember having a conversation with someone over in Dundalk, over in Baltimore County, you know, Dundalk. So there's not a lot of Democrats in Dundalk, and yeah. I'm telling them my plan for small businesses and all this kind of stuff. And one of them said to me, they're like, this is great, but I said, I got to tell you, I'm on the other side. And I said, what does that mean? And they're like, it just means I'm a Republican. And I said, you know, do you know a question I never once asked my soldiers? What's your political party? Never came up. Right? We had one job, one goal, one mission. And my job was to unify our unit around accomplishing that singular mission. And so that's how I plan on governing the state. I think people are tired. I think they're exhausted at being at each other's throats.
Yeah.
I think they're exhausted at this idea that somehow a single party has the market cornered on good ideas. And if anything comes from a place that isn't yours, it somehow means it's a bad idea. I mean, like, I think people are exhausted. And I think people just want to say, I just want someone who's going to hear me out. And even at the end of the day, if I say, listen, I'm with you on these two things. These three things, I'm not there. But I'm with you on these two. So let's work on these two together. I think people respect that. Because they'd be like, he heard me. And he listened. And at the end of the day, you know, if on a Tuesday we don't come to the same conclusion, that's okay. We're going to come back on Wednesday. And we'll have some more stuff to work on. And that's the type of leader I've always been. And that's the type of leader I plan on doing if I, you know, if I have the chance to head to Annapolis.
By the way, that's the most like quintessentially American thing. I mean, that is what this country is supposed to be. That is what this country is, and is the opposite of the creed of this country. Say, I'm not listening to you because you're different, or because I like what is that's just weakness and cow. I mean, what is that?
It is. Yeah. I mean, and I say it's like you know, I'm not interested in making points. I'm interested in scoring them. You know what I mean? It's like, what are we actually trying to get done here?
Yep.
And it goes back to the feeling of frustration that people have, where it's like, well, if it's my person or my party or my this who's in office, and therefore I can get everything done. If it's not, then it's like everything bad is going to happen.
Completely self-defeating.
It's completely self-defeating. And I think it's part of the thing that adds fuel to this frustrating fire that we continue to throw wood into. And that's going to be, frankly, it's remarkably dangerous.
And it's going to prevent good people from running for office.
That's
too,
exactly
right. Because why would you want to get into it when you look at that?
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
What do you want your legacy to be at the end of all this? People look back at you.
I think I just want people to say he did what he said he was going to do. He's a person of his word. You know, that what we're talking about, this is not campaign jargon. It's not, I mean, I don't even understand campaign because I've been a public servant for my whole life. I just haven't been a politician. So I understand that sometimes I don't say the right things or whatever like that. I know what I know, and I am who I am, and I know how I've always moved and maneuvered. I remember even having conversations with people during a primary when they were saying, you know, how do you plan on pivoting if you win the primary? How do you plan on pivoting into the general? Because now you're dealing with a larger audience. You're dealing with not just Democrats, but independents, Republicans. And if I remember, they said, you know, you got 90 seconds to answer the question. And I told them, I said, I need 10, and I'm going to give you the other 80 back. And I said, my answer's simple. I don't.
That's right.
My platform is my platform. My ideas are my ideas. Thoughts are my thoughts. And you'll notice that what we talked about during the primary campaign, if you go back and look like what we're talking about now in the general, you're not going to find any differences. I got into this for the same reasons. Our agenda is the same agenda items. The things we're going to push for is the same agenda items. The leave no one behind agenda is not a primary message. And it's not a general election message either. It's a governing philosophy. And so I guess I just want people to say that, you know, in all respects, whether it was family, whether it was friends, whether it was his work, he did what he said he was going to do. He's a man of his word.
Thank you. You're the best.
Seriously.
Man. Appreciate it, man. That's great.
Yo, y'all are great, man.
Thank you.
Appreciate
Seriously.
You.
I appreciate you.
Thank you, brother.